Susan, Suzanne. Saturday afternoon, January 31st. Susan.
Is this the last day?
Uh-huh.
That one, right?
We gotta go way back and focus. Line out a little of it.
Well, if we go back before Christmas, the reading I ran into that helped me with the country music would be in the history class I took. And it was mostly a book on William Jennings Bryan called The Trumpet Soundeth. And this book wasn't so much about Bryan himself, but it's about Middle America, they called it, the Middle Border. And it began with an introduction to the type of society that Bryan's came from and appealed to, and the type of thinking that he followed and that gained him so many admirers in the Midwest. And this is what kind of helped me a little bit. And basically, they called it a Jeffersonian democracy, which was basically the idea that of the individual's worth in the society, that the individual was the most important element and was fully capable of governing himself and handling his own responsibilities. And this, to me, seemed to work into the country music, because most of the people, when I first started listening to it, country music appeals to people usually from a country background who hold this system of values, at least in the reading, that of the individual and the family and the structure that just family is important, and the man takes care of his family and he works and handles himself, and usually it's on a farm background or some sort of country background where you have this feeling of independence. And that was most of the enjoyed reading the book, because I'd never heard, well, the only reason I'd heard of William Jennings Bryan was with the Scopes monkey trial, where he was a prosecutor. And the book said the reason he was a prosecutor is because he thought that he should represent the majority of Americans, and for him, the majority of Americans opposed teaching of evolution, or they thought it was wrong. And he is a politician, as a lawyer, should represent his constituents. And this was in the book, of course, it was very basic to his ideas and his political beliefs and in his campaigns. That even though he knew it might lose him votes in the East, he would go ahead and back issues that he knew his people, that his constituents believed in, because he felt that his responsibility was to represent them, not his. And of course, he shared their ideas because he came pretty much from their same background. But that was the only connection I'd ever heard of him in. I hadn't known that he'd run 3 times for the presidency.
Yeah.
And the first time, he was pretty young when he got nominated. And they called him Boy Orator because he was quite eloquent. And he got in on a free silver plank, I think, that the populists went in and nominated him, and so did the Democratic Party. And it was the idea that it was a sort of a populist and the farmers in the West against the Eastern bankers and the big money interests, and this was the common enemy that was taking away the rights of the Westerners, because, I mean, that's how they saw it. And how the book presented it, and the book was pretty much favorable toward Bryan, and saw him as a man who helped stuck to his convictions, even though they might have been wrong. Ryder said he probably wouldn't have made a very good president, but at least he he had, you know, he stuck to his conviction. And what was funny, the reaction in the, of a class to this, that hardly any of the students liked him, because they said he wasn't a good politician. Because they said that he opposed the annexation of the Philippines as imperialistic. And they said that if he'd been smart, he could have let that go for a while and maybe done something about it after he got in office instead of making an issue. In other words, they thought he would have been a better man if he'd let his convictions slide until he got elected and then bring them back into in focus. And the teacher, it kind of struck him kind of funny that the class as a majority saw it this way, that he should have been more realistic, they called him, and stick to convictions.
They wanted those Philippines.
Yeah. And what's funny is that everybody yells now about America being an imperialistic country. And they said, well, sure, he was right, but he shouldn't have let being right keep him from getting in office. You know, he should have compromised. And it kind of struck people funny, but the majority of the class didn't like him, simply because if you believe something, he stuck to it. And they may have thought what he believed was right, but it's just that he was so dogmatic about it, they called it, they didn't like him. And I guess I did the reading before I started really paying much attention to the country music. That's I think that's a part of it, that they see it going, they saw it going, and they don't. I guess in a way they know it's gone, but still they, it's so much, so real to them, they can hardly believe it.
You know, your sister,
mm-hmm. Right, because it just goes on and you see it and there's nothing to do about it. Some more of the reading was a book by Marshall McLuhan, and he said that Americans, but not just Americans, but people go into the future looking in a rearview mirror, he called it. And what he had, had a picture of a car mirror, and in the car mirror you could see all the buggies. And that people, when they're going into new, changing things, try to hold on to the most immediate past, and they drag it along with them. And people don't like to see change, I don't think. I find myself sort of opposed to a lot of things, simply because they're changing. Because I guess people get used to something, and they feel unsure in a new situation. One part that I run into is with the church. And I never sort of raised a Presbyterian background, and so the church to me is not really all that terrible. And in fact, but I see, you know, that a lot of it is bad. It'd be better off if it weren't. They say they have folk masses where, like, they have a jazz mass, they have a jazz communion service where they have the regular communion service, but they play jazz music to go along with it. Now, in a way, I enjoy that, but then again, I don't like to see it because I felt that the Mass, I'm used to the type of music that goes along with the Mass, and the more the formal, the traditional way. And so I find myself not Mass, communion, paying more attention to the music than the service itself. And this seems a drawback, and so they say that the jazz communion service, the folk masses, are simply to bring the church more into the society, make it more relevant to folk. And it seems like if you make it more relevant, you can lose any distinctiveness of its own. And, you know, any worth that it had by being different, it loses by being made like everything else.
That Western's music then has that strong motion feel.
Yeah. Well, it's partly to them it maintains the entity. Mother. slide your eyes off or something. I'm glad we stayed Sunday night.
I never had that picture again.
There's an easy chair, and he sits with me and then he sits with me. He crosses his arms over his stomach and leans his head back. He comes in and he says, "Hey, how are you doing?" "I'm pretty fine." Talk a little bit and go out and just stay here and be down the road. Normal volume.
No, it wasn't background music. He was listening to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he couldn't even do anything else. Because he wasn't sleeping. He was listening. And some of it is subdued, and others get to run ahead. For a long time, they had a program where Merle Haggard was imitating Jimmy Rogers. And this is his thing. One of the first country singers that Jim was talking about, Jimmy Rogers. And you have Jimmy Rogers. Not having any money, not having much hope, but still sticking it out.
Well, I'll tell you, I never did. You know, I'm not experienced, but pretty close to experience. When you drive an orange truck and those grooves, and these kind of work very hard, you know what money means.
I bet that you did.
Yes, I know.
I drove an orange truck. He said sometimes he made 7 trips a week. Most of it was 5. But he drove all the way back and ran back each time. He said he used to get in that truck, he'd get so tired he'd stop the truck and get out and run around a couple times, get back in and drive on. Or stop and get coffee or really mild.
Cookie did that too.
Mm-hmm. And he said after he got married, he couldn't do that much longer. He worked about 2 more months. With an orange truck. And then he worked as a carpenter a while, and then he got on with the civil service.
Is Nell more critical than you?
She likes it, but she's not as inclusive as she is in liking. Like I guess you'd say she's more critical. It's not, she just doesn't enjoy as much as he does. He enjoys most any of them, but she's picks out the one she likes.
No.
Because she, like I wrote in the letter, she
saw that
people who listen to it associate the music with their own background, their own hard times. Now, she wasn't as bad off as Houston. Her uncle had a farm, but her parents, I don't think, farmed. They worked at the Grove. And so she hasn't had that quite the same background. So she appreciates style more than she does just the music. Like she, there's one program, it's Kitty Wells. And this Kitty Wells, she must be about 50, and Bue says she's been singing 20 or 30 years. Well, her whole family gets on there. And she's got a son about 30. And they sit there, Bue and Nell, and laugh at him because he tries to get this real offhand, easygoing manner with the women on the show and the men, you know, joking and all this. But he can't quite carry it off because it's too forced. And they say, well, he's got a long way to go. he's a beginner at it. And they figure, well, eventually he'll be pretty good at it. But, you know, he's got a long way to go. And that's what Nell said about him. But that show's pretty bad. They're heavy-handed about it. About the jokes and things. And they have this clown that's supposed to be a clown. He has a big flower in his hat and a polka dot shirt and everything. And most of the country music shows have a clown, but not of that time. This one just walks on the stage or goes off or carries a banjo. It doesn't do anything but walk on and off, and this is supposed to be funny. But it's too artificial. Whereas the Porter Wagoner, their clown is a guy named Speck, and he doesn't have any front teeth. All his top front teeth is gone. He wears a little derby-type hat, and he's supposed to be the ignorant, you know, the town idiot, sort of. Where he's not real dumb. I mean, he's pretty dumb, but he's not an idiot. And with that, they can work in jokes like, Porter Wagoner says, I saw you with your girl downtown. She looks like a real nice girl. You know, Speck says, yeah, she's a real nice girl. Comes from a good family, you know. And so Porter Wagoner says, well, I hope you keep do everything on the square with her. And Speck says, no, you don't do that in public. We go out and park somewhere. This is a type of humor that goes on with the clown. But the Porter Wagoner show is much better than the other one simply because it's carried off better. Well, I think the farm in Nell is a place to visit where Bue was raised on Georgia's dirt farm, he and his brothers. And so all he knew was the farm life until his oldest brother came down to Florida, and then after a while Bue came along. But he said that he used to get tickled. His mother lived with him for a while before she died, and she used to get tickled because whenever his mother would talk about someone working for a salary or working in town, she'd call it working for wages rather than working for themselves on the farm. But I think Bue's background must be a lot less money than Nell ever had. I'm sure Nell's family wasn't ever rich, but, you know, they never worried about it, and she lived in a town, usually. Whereas, well, like she said, that the Christmas with the corn pone and the water gravy and just the salt pork. And I don't imagine she ever knew a Christmas quite that bare. So she's 9 years younger than he is. So she you know, wouldn't have had as much experience with, wouldn't have been as old during the Depression as Bue was.
I didn't finish that one on linguistics. But after about 5 hours knocking it out, I was all worn out.
5 hours?
Yeah.
I didn't think you'd spend 5 hours on anything.
I usually spend more than 5 hours on most things.
Including your birthday party.
My birthday party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well.
You don't linger and get hung up.
Yeah, I do.
I don't believe this is that.
You ask my husband.
You
think I'd sit around for hours and just
yeah.
Stuck in with my nose in a book?
I can't believe it.
I have to.
No.
Yeah. Within the last week and a half, did you ever try to race through Hawthorne's Tales, The Marble Faun, 50 pages of phonemics, 2 books for phonemics, I'm 2 behind.
I don't call that getting hung up. That's
yeah, that's hung up.
Covering territory.
Yeah, well. Covered so bad you don't know what's covered. Well, I did it on anthropology and linguistics. I started off with anthropology. And it's what we were talking about last week. I mean, I think this is some value in anthropology that you can apply to your experience and in linguistics, approach from an anthropological point of view. Well, I suppose that in anthropology, it's not the facts that you learn about other cultures. You know, you study aspects of all other cultures, religion, kinship, all kinds of things. It's not the facts that you learn, it's the attitude that you learn toward the facts. It's kind of, after you study all these different systems and you see that there's so many different ways of looking at the world, and one is no better than the other. In fact, probably some others are a lot better than your own way. That it kind of, the effect that it has on you is that it kind of forestalls any reaction you might have to seeing someone else's view that's completely different from yours. That without this kind of outlook that you gain from taking anthropology, that your first reaction might be to say something like, how odd, you know, to regard somebody as a curiosity rather than as just different, just another way. You might tend to view it as kind of like a scientific observation, you know, remove yourself from it. But after you've had enough anthropology, you realize that that some ways are better than your own, looking at things, and you tend to get immediately into the situation without that reaction that tends to remove you from it. And what I wrote about in the paper was, for example, you were going out to Hawthorne like I did before you start classes, and the kind of classroom that you catch sight of as you go into the building. First of all, it's this decrepit old building. It's just that there are about six classrooms. The floors are just filthy. The floor is wave. You know, they're covered with chalk dust. There's paper all over everything. And all you hear is bedlam, you know, as you walk in the front door of the school. The first classroom you catch sight of, this happened to me, the first classroom you catch sight of, they just finished playing a recording of one of Poe's short stories, I think it was. And everyone in the classroom up toward the front wanted to say something, and they were all shouting, trying to shout each other down, you know, in their eagerness to say something. But it wasn't just the noise. It was just what was going on in there. They weren't just shouting. So there was one boy who, this was a class that I was going to have. There was one boy named Jesse, who I got to know a lot better later, who was this little black boy. He was about just a lot shorter than all the rest of them, but full of energy. I had more energy than any others. He was dancing in the aisle, you know, trying to get the attention of the teacher. And he knew all the latest steps. He was a real fancy little guy. You know, the girls just loved him. He knew all the latest steps. And he was up in the aisle dancing, you know, with his eyes rolled back, his hands flaying the air, trying to get the attention of the teacher. No, it's not hard to believe at all. You got to Hawthorne for one day and you won't have any trouble. that's only the half of it.
I might not get back.
Well, a lot of days I thought I wouldn't too.
Culture shock.
Yeah, it's just your ethnocentrism doesn't come in real handy when you hit Hawthorne. But you know, it's that kind of situation that, let's say it'd be like this, half of the back of the class, you know, would be all the kids that they would all get out of their chairs, you know, pretend like they were shooting guns at each other, ducking behind their chairs and running down the aisles. And the ones that were halfway paying attention up in front, you know, were all trying to get the attention of the teacher. And it was bedlam. And if you come into that kind of a situation with preconceptions fixed in your mind about what a classroom should be like and how learning takes place, then you would never make it. You have to, and I think this is part of what anthropology does for you. You come in and you don't immediately try to reform the situation. It takes away that impulse to make things the way you think they should be. You just sort of let it ride and try and find out their way and see how you can fit yourself to it. Because in that kind of a situation, these kids, I mean, they hadn't brought their voices in from the outside yet. This is the way they were, out playing in the yard, out in the street. This is the way around their house. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, if they shout back to their father, they're going to get beaten, and they know it. And they live in a physical world. And when you go into that classroom, it's the same way.
Man,
you have to have an iron hand.
They use that outdoor voice in there?
Yeah. They shout, every one of them. They shout constantly. The first week I was there, I lost my voice for 2 weeks after the first week I was there.
See, then I haven't noticed, I mean, I haven't noticed the pattern of you. You haven't told me anything about it.
You know?
I did everything for the test.
You didn't ask me.
I can't resist an outdoor voice. I simply cannot resist them.
Well, you'd love it out there.
It just hurts me to see the loss of that outdoor voice.
Not outdoor. In fact, you develop a better one yourself if you're going to get up in front of that class.
Sure.
You got to go in there swinging if you want to be alive.
I love that outdoor voice. I tell you what, I never was conscious of it until that time after I came to Florida. I was just shot around everywhere. I was up at White Springs, or White Sulphur Springs, up past Lake City, on the Suwannee River. And there used to be a half a dozen or so big hotels there. Just one left, that was the burn. One afternoon, late, takeoff time, the old timers, they were the people who'd been coming, the visitors, one of the for years and years and years, their lifetime. They were sort of the center for the supper. And the man that owned the place was there. And they'd come up one by one, and I tried to sit there where I could hear. And I saw for the first time, they pull those split-bottom chairs up to the railing, put feet on the railing, talk to each other, but they threw the voice out. That's the first time I was conscious. Of the outdoor voice. Same thing as wearing your hat in the house, isn't it?
Exactly.
And you know, when that hit me, it didn't hit me just suddenly, it just came to me a little at a time, really. My mind never worked like you all do. I just get nostalgic every time I think about it. I wish I could go back up there for a day or two.
Go out to Hawthorne, it'll bring it all back.
I'm going, I will.
I'm telling you, you should go go. Just sit in on one of those classes. It'll be an experience you'll never forget. You try and teach one, that'll be an experience. That's kind of just a little picture of what the classes are like at Hawthorne. If you really want to get the picture, you have to stay all day and go through four or five classes and get them all ages, because I was teaching at grade 7 through 12. And that way, you see them from the time they're 12 until the time they're, well, one of mine was 21.
Yeah.
A big colored boy that was about 8 times bigger than I am. But he was a good boy. He was a lot better than some of them. So, the younger ones really were a lot more interesting than the older ones, because they hadn't learned to tone down their outdoor voices, you might say. They were still really in the rough. I had a class, my class of seventh graders, I was teaching science to my seventh grade class. And I was teaching three basic classes out of four classes. And when you say basic class at Hawthorne, that means like half of the class are probably borderline retardates that haven't been able to get into special classes. And say one of my basic classes, my 11th and 12th graders were on. All they've been doing for 5 years was cutting out pictures from magazines and pasting them on cardboard. And that was the extent of what they've been doing in class. Basic class. For my seventh graders, there were a lot of interesting kids in that class. There was Donnie and Ronnie Wilson, who had just gotten out of special education classes and been put into regular classes. And they were 15 years old. They weren't identical twins, I don't think. They were twins, though. They were 15 years old, but they were so undernourished and emaciated, especially one of them, that I really thought they were 12. And the time he told me that he was 15, when Ronnie told me he was 15, I didn't believe him because they lied constantly. I didn't think he was 15, but he was. He used to chew tobacco in school and sit up there in the front of the class and never did anything, never took a test, never listened, just caused trouble all the time. But I liked him. I liked Ronnie. I didn't like Donnie, the other one.
Did they lie or just pull your leg?
No, they lied. They were confirmed liars. They didn't pull my leg. They knew it. They knew what they were doing. Now, they'd do anything to get out of class. All of them would. They'd do anything to get out of class. They'd forge notes from other teachers. They'd get passes. They'd steal passes. You know, just the usual pranks of junior high school. But it seemed like at our Hawthorne, they were a lot more ingenious, you know, than other kids I'd ever seen. I know they were more ingenious than the kids I went to school with. The kids I went to school with were scared. These kids weren't scared of anybody. Like, they had an assistant principal that would paddle the kids, girls and boys. The only thing that they knew. And if you sent a kid out of your class, you knew that was what was going to happen to him, no matter how big he was. The biggest or the littlest, girl or boy, he'd get paddled. And even then, that didn't really, I don't think that scared them. They weren't really afraid of getting sent out. But these little seventh graders, I really took to them because they were still so alive, especially the little black ones. They just loved to jump out of their seats and dance on the desks, and they get out of their seats and start hopping up and down the aisles, ducking under the desks. This is why you're trying to teach class. Which is a joke, because you never really taught class in the sense that you'd think of, say, in a middle class school. You didn't get up there and give them a lesson, and then they'd memorize it and you'd test them on it. You were lucky if you could get out maybe two questions and have, you know, get them even to look up before it was some other disturbance in one part of the class. But most of it was because most of the ones that were the, you know, the borderline retardate would, well, first of all, they wouldn't do anything in connection with the class. They were totally uncooperative. They would be so bored, naturally, that all they wanted to do was play and cause trouble. And so the rest of them just went along with it. And so the class was bedlam. You know, you just shouted constantly. Like I said, I lost my voice. And that class was the main cause of it. It wasn't the older ones. It was those younger ones. We had two teachers in there at once to handle. I needed help. I could do that on my own. I'd be exhausted after that class. I couldn't move. I used to come home at night and just die. After I'd be in Hawthorne all day. That's why I never did anything else. It's physical there. It's physical exercise. It's not mental. I mean, it's not, let's say, intellectual. You don't go out there and teach. You just talk with them, you know, and hope that somehow you get something across. But had started to, you know, they were starting to grow up, and so they felt they had to act different. Growing things and that sort of thing. But they thought a lot of other things they managed to. The older ones were, that was the only class I had that had, say, anything other than basic, what they called basic. So, actually, the basic kids were a lot more interesting than the others, so. Because not all of them were stupid. They had just been pushed into this year after year of not ever learning anything, and this is where they ended up. It wasn't that they were stupid, all of them. Some of them were, but not all of them were. My 10th grade class had a lot of, you might call the kids of the elite of Hawthorne. They were the ones that ran for student government positions and wanted to make good grades. And they were a lot different. They weren't anything like these other kids. It was much worse. because they were, they thought they were real sophisticated. I mean, real sophisticated. So sophisticated that to show any interest in school was out. But they wanted to make good grades. They didn't do anything, but they wanted to make good grades. They were, well, it's hard to describe them. Oh, they were all different. I had five boys in there that couldn't read. I had a boy in there that could not read the word cat. And the teacher that was helping me out would take them out of the class. Then I had one boy in there that was real bright and a good boy. And then I had a lot of other ones just sat there, like little Laura Cook was in that class. And they didn't want to do anything. She was just as bad as all the rest of them. They'd sit back there and go to sleep, or they didn't make noise. They just wouldn't want to listen to what you were saying. And yet, if you give them a D or an E on their report card, they'd come in and say, do anything to get that grade changed. Linguistics ties in with the anthropology, really, because when you study linguistics from an anthropological point of view, you study the languages of other cultures and their characteristics, which are often completely different. I can't tell you how much I learned in studying linguistics in anthropology. I never realized in a million years that there were that many differences in languages in different cultures that control the way people look at the world. Because you get so used to thinking, in fact, there's no other way. You have to think about your experiences in terms of your language, because thought has to follow the track that language has laid down. And it's really amazing how different other people look at the world. The examples that I think were brought up most often in the course that I was taking was the one of the Hopi Indians who didn't...
They were sure, horrified.
Well, I will. I'm getting to that. I have to explain the point, though, is that the fact that language is based on classification. Every word is a symbol for a concept. And every culture, every language, divides up experience into different ways. When you study this, and when you realize it, although you don't find anything that exotic at Hawthorne, you don't find anything, say, like the Hopi Indian, the differences, or say, like in Chinese, where they don't have the two-valued way of looking at things that we do, say, good and bad, black and white. We end up getting a lot of fanatics over here because we have this bipolar view of things. Chinese don't have anything like that. They have everything in between, but no extremes. Now, when you study about things like that, and you realize that everyone classifies experience in different ways, it brings it home so much more than if someone just said it to you. So you go out to Hawthorne, and you see the different ways that they look at things compared to the way you look at things. You're so much more conscious of it. They classify their experiences in different ways. Say their view of the school. Now, the school within their culture is completely different, say, than the school in the culture or the subculture that I went to school in. Say the Mullinses, the people that I've talked about before, they couldn't have viewed the school. Now, I don't know, because I wasn't around their home, talked to their family about it. But their view of the school, they couldn't have felt that it was very important. In fact, they probably felt that it hurt the kids because they had to go to school with black kids. And that was something that they just didn't want to happen. But the law makes them send their kids to school. But from the way that the kids behave in school, say Larry, for instance. Now, you know that when he goes home at night, his parents aren't going to make him do his homework. He would never come in with a speck of anything that you had assigned him the day before. In fact, I could almost hear him, just in the way he acted and behaved in class, I could almost hear his father saying, oh, that school isn't any good, it's not going to teach you anything that's of any use. And I'm sure most of them felt that way. They didn't like school, they only came because they had to. And when you try to cope with that in a class, well, It's not like all these kids that know they're going to go to college, you know, and they hit the classroom and they're so eager, it makes you sick, you know, and they just want you to tell them everything. They want you to give them the word, you know, with a capital W, just like these freshmen that I teach. Now, that's their attitude. Compare that with the attitude, the way that the Hawthorne kids classify their experience. The school doesn't have it function at all. It's just there because they have to go there until they're, most of them are just waiting to drop out when they're, what, 16? That's what they tell me. Or else they'd say, like one of my girls in my 8th grade class, I said, why don't you ever do anything? You haven't done a thing since I came here. Hardly lift your head up off the desk. And she says, well, I'm just waiting until I'm 16, and I drop out and live on welfare. She says, that's what my parents have done. That's what I'm going to do. I didn't have any answer to that.
Now, that's the polarized.
Yeah, you're not going to find anything that basically different. Mm-hmm. Because they speak the same language you do, basically, even though there are a lot of differences. Some of the ways that linguistics tie in more, I think, is the stuff you learn about grammar when you study linguistics. Quote, bad grammar. When you learn that there's no such thing as bad grammar or incorrect speech, then you're never going to be shocked again to go and say, you come out of your little middle class education and go into a Hawthorne school, and the first thing that just assaults your ears, you know, is he don't and them boys and all this, you know. And if you don't realize that that's a dialect, it's just a dialect of this subculture, that you might draw away from that, not be able to handle that. Saying he don't and them boys too. And I know I did. I was talking that way after I was out there in no time at all. There's nothing wrong with it. It communicates. I don't really believe what you say about Hester. That she, what had happened to her from the effect of what society did to her. That she was involved in it. I mean, let's not say that I don't believe what you said after, is that I'm not sure that, you know, that it applies anywhere else in Hawthorne. In Hester, I can see it, that she was involved in her experience, that she, this was the action. When she was living with the letter A all that time, until finally, it, as Emerson said, it detached itself from her experience and went into the realm of thought. And yeah, by that time she had been beaten down by society. And that she could think about it then, finally. What you say about her, you know, the fact that Hawthorne was doing a study in exactly what Emerson is talking about. I can see it in Hester, but I can't see it anywhere else in Hawthorne.
As you explain it, it's not Emersonian.
Well, that seems like what it is.
That's not what I said.
Well, you explain it. Again.
You know,
that was the way I saw it when I read it. Doesn't make sense, huh?
I think that the one and only thing Emerson is talking about is that the individual is his perceptions. When his mind is open.
Mm-hmm.
Now Hester, as Hawthorne represents it, you see. She has been caught in these traps, in this trap of society.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what anyone has to do, that has to happen to them.
Right, before he can.
Yes. But what it is, what it does, it enables the mind to see that society is a trap.
Wasn't that what I just said? She couldn't think about it until she'd been through it. That it came from her experience.
Yes. Yes. Now, when you say beaten down, persecuted, same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And Hawthorne has a much more rougher view of society than Emerson. As you see it in his treatment of Heston.
But can you see that any... Say, take Hawthorne's tale.
Yeah.
Can you see any Emerson? I don't see how you can, you know... Hawthorne, to me, it just gets real old. I don't like to read it because there's not none of that in there. I can't see it, at least, say in the tale.
Mm-hmm.
He works from an idea, and then he makes it into a... He puts ideas into characters and then makes them work.
Well, now, who are you reading that with?
Dr. Bigler.
Yeah, well, that's the difference in Dr. Bigler and me.
No, but see...
If you were reading it with me, you'd see it as experience and not an idea.
Well, see, I had no choice. I had to read it 2 weeks ago.
That's all right.
But see, besides that, though, even, you know, say I can look at it from the other point of view, I still don't see it.
Yeah.
Because, and it's not that my mind's been poisoned, because reading Hawthorne on my own, I just don't like it. Because it, well, I mean, how can you account for all that stuff? How can you account for Hester being compared to the divine, Hester being compared to the virgin? How can you account for, he hits you over the head with it. It's so obvious. You know, he said, or the A in the sky, or the rose bush outside of the prison that survived through society's black society, I think he said.
And the now you see what I do in the Scarlet Letter, I could use some of the others. Oh yes, you can use the others.
Use one of the others.
that's sort of your proving ground in the Scarlet Letter. Or say Hawthorne. Now,
he's going to look at things under moonlight. He's going to look at it, at things removed from experience.
That's his use of the term romance, yes.
Now, I don't really regard it as the term romance doesn't, you know, pin me down. That doesn't bother me. It's all these other things that you find in there. Why does he say things like, you know, it would seem to say, you know, and then he always makes some pronouncement or some symbolic, you know, it just hits you over the head with it. You know, you get real, I mean, do you agree with me or not?
Yeah, that part kind of bugs me a little bit. We're just not used to that thing.
I don't care. I don't like Hawthorne, and I just think that, you know, he makes it full of all the symbolism, you know, and I don't see how you could miss it. And it's hard to look for anything else because he hits you over the head with it.
I never expected that from...
That. Well, I've just been reading some of the Hawthorne, and I'm sick of them. After you read The Marble Faun, after you read The Scarlet Letter, after you read 18 Tales, you know, you get really sick of them.
Yeah.
That's one thing that kind of bothered me. You know, that book that we had with the Norton edition with the critical things. Well, on the footnotes, they had all this bit about how symmetrical the novel is and all this kind of
height.
Stuff. Yeah, time. And that chapter one balances chapter, the last chapter, and the second to last balances this. Where it seems to me that we look at it in one way, from experience, from say the Emerson point of view, but yet that other is there too, you know, and that's the kind of thing the other teachers teach generally, the symmetrical, or the ambiguity,
or the symbolism.
The symbolism, and that they all see this, and that it's all there, and that you just look at a different point of view when you read it, and it's just, it seems to me, it's a matter of trying to determine which is the most important. And it seemed like if you just had symmetricalness and ambiguity and symbolism without anything to back it up, all you'd have is just a technical tour de force.
Well, you have things to back it up, Suzanne, but he doesn't give it to you straight. It seems to me that he always has to take it above, you know. He has to put it on another level and then handle it.
Oh, that's what Mr. Spiller said, that Hawthorne was capable.
I haven't read Spiller, but...
He said that Hawthorne himself, and then his art, too, were incapable of...
Art and really grasping.
Grasping the reality.
Reality.
Yes.
But doesn't that distort the experience part of it for you?
He said that back in the 20s, and that was the beginning of scholarship. So now you've got to get up a little past the 20s.
Well, I read on Matheson.
Oh, on Hawthorne?
Mm-hmm. I just wrote a page. I just finished writing a paper, 20-page paper. That's why I'm sick of it, see? That's why I'm so down on Hawthorne.
It could be. You see, you haven't reached Hawthorne yet.
Well, maybe so.
I think you got to read it all in one glump. It's just kind of...
But I've always felt that way about Hawthorne. First time I ever had to read Scarlet Letter, I said, this is just too much.
You don't even see Hester. You're not even talking about Hester. That first view of Hester is not sustained. Hawthorne has art. Hawthorne hadn't learned the art of sustaining it. But it's a glimpse.
You mean the burning blush and the haughty smile?
Mm-hmm. That's not all of it, though. And it's not just that.
No.
Hawthorne in that had a glimpse of an Emersonian personality, such as Emerson really never had.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that Thoreau really had that glimpse. Now, Thoreau's, what he could see was something different. But in Hester, I don't like to jump from one story and all like that to another. But now look. You have a view of a personality there such as you have never had before. You have never had a glimpse of such a personality as that. It's just not in your vocabulary, not in your experience. And you've got to live with that a while and come to grips with it. Or else you'd just be talking about it logically and mentally and quipping about it. He has the experience and the insight. And it's there, in that first little view of Hester. And once you see that, Hester will just stay in your mind. And just be so close to you.
Well, see, I have nothing against that. I believe that Hester is that way.
But you can't.
But I just can't accept the rest of Hawthorne.
No. You can't talk that glibly now. If you see that, no, you can't.
Okay, I'll live with it a while and see then what comes out.
You can't do that. No, sir. And that next view of Hester at her needle. That is a more sustained view, and he's actually treating in a critical way this subject that Emerson has. Now in that. It depends partly on your own appreciation or understanding or critical understanding of society and institutions. And from the way you talk about them, you have utmost confidence in them. that they'll never let you down. From the way you talk.
I think so, huh? They've already let me down plenty.
That's the way you talk. As you have no...
I don't notice my religion hanging around to help me out. Or
view, you see, of what institutions are.
I don't notice school hanging around to help me out. I don't notice anything.
They're all just rosy. They're all just rosy, you see? And there's not a one, you see, if from the Hawthorne's point of view. Yes. And that next view, you see, after 7 years,
right,
at Walden, withdrawn, retirement. After 7 years, what he shows you in again a glimpse, because his art not sustained. You see, he's more at home really in the tales. I mean, that's his art. That's the art. Is he's taking the art of the tales over to the novel, and it doesn't quite work. But that's the fruit of that experience and that insight. And I don't think Hawthorne could make it stronger than he does. There, all by herself, she has a glimpse of a world that Descartes had, and Newton and Locke after him. I don't believe he could make it stronger. You see? Now that's almost a revelation that he sees in Hester. The little articles show you see that he says that grudgingly. He won't allow her or anyone else, you see, the whole fruits of it. The world's not made like that. He's not quite as optimistic as Emerson. But he's on the point of... He gives her the glimpse. She can't hold on to it. But now that's Hawthorne. No, that's... No, sir. You see, in part, you see, the little groups, even at the university, are out of control now. But the stage was set for them to take hold and try their wings. It was ready for them, and if they had taken hold, they could done it. They could have read Hawthorne, and they could read Hester in an Emersonian way. They could have. Now that little taking hold they did yesterday, I thought it was right valiant, but it's just about as feeble as you could possibly imagine. Now that's not Hawthorne, that's the chaps. They just simply don't have the mental and emotional muscles to take hold. Now, they couldn't line it out the way I did, but they could have got enough out of that I would not have had to do it. You see, it's disillusioning for me to have to do that.
Well, you've been doing it the whole term. They haven't really done anything.
They haven't done anything. Well, now we'll do that the rest of the time. Now that's your categories. Nobody who speaks in terms of linguistics or the social sciences will ever give you as much circumstantial detail as you gave about the Mullins or about your little girls dancing in the classroom and the aisle. Then none of them will do it.
No.
It'll be all intellectual. Wholly intellectual. And I don't believe your other instructors do it. Or ever call your attention to it.
No.
Now that's not me, that's Emerson and Thoreau. And what I say, all I'm saying to you, and you see, I gave you the other things to read so that you wouldn't be get a biased account of it, or one-sided account of it. It seems to me like that Emersonian view sort of corrects the whole modern mentality and shows you where the whole English department, say, can be wacky.
Well, I always thought they were before I ran into Emerson. Because they don't get down.
Oh, they're gone. Give me the word.
Oh, baloney. I'll teach you a bunch of... I could get that. Anything they tell me, I can get on my own. Just by going out and... it's just not... It's not reading the criticism. I mean, it's not anything. It's not the heart of the matter, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But I knew that. I mean, that's just my way of looking at things. I'm a lot more accepting now than I ever used to be. I used to be right bitter about almost everything.
What's that?
But people are just a bunch of...
Did you ever hear that?
Yeah, oh,
I heard
of it. Now.
Huh?
I'm real accepting.
When did you used to be bitter? That's
oh, my
God.
Since I was a junior in high school. Till about a year ago.
Well, the time I knew you, you weren't.
That's right.
Well, what happened
to you? I tried
to
calm down.
Huh?
Well, I just got a lot more accepting. Not a whole lot you can do about it. So. It's the truth. I never knew anybody that was worth much of anything.
You know what Thoreau says?
I know, a man will never let you down.
A man will
I know,
never
they've let me
down.
Not if you approach it the right way, I know. Well, I haven't approached it in the right way.
And over the back fence.
That's right. If you don't approach intellectuals over the back fence, you're not ever going to find a meeting ground to approach them on.
You don't fool around with intellectuals.
Yeah, well, that's all I've been exposed to, going to college for 5 years.
Well, God's trying to get
that's why I have to go out and find my own friends.
And you know what's funny? Kids hate an intellectual. When he's their age, they hate him. I swear, we got a class, and there's a guy in there, and everybody, the minute he walks in, you feel everybody tighten up, you know. And he gets in there, and he answers questions, and he goes on, and he brings in Nietzsche, and he brings in anything you can talk about. Everybody sits there, you know, and they look at each other, and they grin, and they watch the clock, see how long he's going to talk this time. And you just tell
make a great
class.
Professor, right? Right in the medium.
I'm a little surprised at you.
Well, that's because you don't know me too well.